Yeah, the second one?
Looks a decade.
Okay, so this is actually the beginning of the sixth session. Here, this is our summer mini-mester.
Take mine and I'll share with
her. No, it's okay, I'll share with her. She's got it.
This is the first class of the sixth session, and we're going to do mitzvot 152 through 158, Bezrat Hashem.
Do we have the money to check? The first class.
So the question is, how many sessions do you want to do, five or six? And are we doing Memorial Day or not?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Not Memorial Day, and then we can't do the 16th. No, the 16th, because I won't be here. So it's this week, next week, skip the following week. Then I think we have the next week we're on. Then it's Memorial Day. And then the question is, how many Mondays in June do we want?
Makes no difference to me.
Then I go through the 20th to make it six.
This is the
16th. I didn't see Shavuos on the calendar. You're pulling out a calendar? Do you have a calendar? Yeah.
It is.
When is Shavuos? It's not on a Monday, right?
No. Shavuos is like, is it June 6th and 7th or 7th and 8th?
Well, oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Congratulations.
I think it's a Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah. Monday night, Tuesday, Wednesday is what I think.
Oh, Monday night. So it is.
Well,
Eric, but we'll still do it.
Exactly from.
We can meet that morning. Yeah.
First night really? Baseball, right?
Right.
Really?
Right. Makes sense. Okay.
That's a new one.
So.
Monday night, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Monday night, yeah, right. Monday night, Tuesday day, Wednesday day, yeah. So we can meet that morning, though. Does that work for you to meet that morning?
I would not come.
You wouldn't come?
I probably wouldn't either.
I'll be in New York for Chovev graduation.
Oh, that day?
Okay.
Sunday. It's Sunday.
So oh, okay. So then we won't meet that day, Erev Shavuos. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So not that day.
No, Erev Shavuos.
And then, so then the question is, do you want to meet until the 20th?
Sure. It's my birthday.
Yeah?
I don't know. I might have a job or not, so I'm not sure.
Until the 20th of June.
Right. Is that too late into June?
The 13th and the
20th? Yeah.
That'd be okay for me.
So let's do that then. Okay, so that makes it only 5 weeks, so then I'll just have to calculate and bring in for next week.
So tell me again, we do have class next week.
We do have class next week.
I won't be here.
Yeah, I won't
no
be here
class
either.
The 16th.
Correct.
And no class the 23rd?
The 23rd, we do have a class.
We do have a class. Yes. I thought you said two in a row.
No, we do. Okay. On the 23rd, then not on Memorial Day. And then not Erev Shavuos, because that just got nixed. And then, right? And then, so that skips 2 weeks in a row.
So May 23rd.
The 16th, you're gone. The 23rd, we're good.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. The 30th, yeah. We're not. The
7th.
What's it?
No, that's Shavuos.
Right, so we're not doing it the, is that the 6th, Allison? Is that Sunday?
Monday.
Yes, that is
Monday,
6th.
The
5th is Sunday.
Right, the 6th, not the 6th, because Erev Shavuos.
Okay.
And then, yes, the what are the next
13th.
Two dates? The 13th and the 20th.
20th.
Okay.
So that's
30th,
five.
No. 23rd, yes.
Okay. Correct. Okay, so those are our dates for this session, and I'll have to calculate
so
the math
birthday.
Next time.
Yeah, next week is a yes also, right?
Next week
happy
is a yes.
Birthday. Oh, thank you.
Oh, is it your birthday?
Happy birthday.
Today?
Today.
Oh, that's
today
so nice.
Today is Parent Day.
Let it Samaya.
Wow, very nice. You should live and be well and have many returns of the day. Okay, so let's just imagine we all had a toast. And what if we did just have a toast and drank some wine in honor of Marilyn's birthday? Mm-hmm. We would not be able to give a ruling on the Torah, according to this mitzvah.
If we had
sense. That actually makes sense.
Yeah.
I want a sober judge.
Right. So so here is the halacha of 152. After drinking wine, a Kohen should not enter the sanctuary, and no one is to give a ruling. It's interesting, actually.
No,
it didn't occur to me until just this minute. How do you have two halachas actually in one mitzvah? Really? Right? I mean, they're united
should
by
not
the
not enter and not drink, rule.
Well, it's wine. Kohanim and ordinary
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
Right, so they're both united in the after drinking wine, but then it's really two separate things. I would think this should be two separate mitzvahs, because for the Kohen, he's not allowed to even enter the sanctuary, let alone do anything in it. But for the ordinary person, they are allowed to enter the sanctuary, but they're not allowed to render any rulings, because they wouldn't be doing anything in the sanctuary.
What about drinking wine when they make Kiddush?
Not allowed to enter the sanctuary, or do a halachic ruling.
Really?
Yeah. So no halachic ruling. It has to do with a certain amount, so you can see here the amount is, because it can't just be a sip of wine.
It says intoxicated.
Right. So the question is, what is intoxicated? It's not very much. It's one revi'it, That's 3.2 ounces is the minimum amount for a revit. So it's basically one glass of wine. You know, so if you have one glass of wine, you're not allowed to render a halachic ruling, unless it's interesting, because it says in here, where does it say that? It's interesting. You're allowed to render a halachic ruling that's one that even the Sadducees would render, meaning those guys, you know, don't...
They're the bad guys.
They're the bad guys,
yeah.
But at least they recognize the most basic written rulings. So if it's so obvious that you can read it straight out of the text, you're not judging on anything. There's no judgment involved, but it's just straight up Torah text. You know, you're not allowed to eat a pig. You know, if somebody says, can I have bacon? You're allowed to render the ruling no, even when you're drunk, because everybody agrees with that. That's just not, it's so obvious. Right, so you don't have to, there's no judgment in that. So, right, so it's interesting. So the actual mitzvah is about wine, and it extends to strong drink, but it's an extension to strong drink, meaning any other intoxicating substance. So there's different punishments for wine and for other types of strong drink. So so the actual mitzvah itself is on wine and is on straight wine, not mixed wine, but even if you have mixed wine, so...
It's interesting. Wine, the penalty is death.
Right.
And other, the penalty is whiplash.
Right. Right.
So stick to vodka.
Right, so I think it's fascinating also, and I was just wondering, what does that mean? I don't have an answer for you, but I'm just wondering, is there an intoxication that's different with wine than it is with other drinks?
Wine has been different than this drink.
But even if it was.
Or more strong than other things.
Even if it was, and really chemically it can't be that much stronger than it is today, because the fermentation process kills the, let's see, I forgot exactly how it works, but they, at a certain point of alcoholic content, the alcohol kills the yeast that allows it to ferment. So it can only get to, in general, 12, I think the most is 14. Is as far as it can chemically achieve, you would have to strengthen it in another way, like distill it further, if you want to make it more alcoholic than that.
Does it have to do with wine is sanctified? Or was, I mean...
Right, so that's what I'm wondering.
I mean,
what?
You know, you can't make Kiddush over vodka.
I think you can.
Over scotch?
I think you can. People make Kiddush over non-wine hard drinks, yeah. But not Friday night.
You wouldn't make Hagafen, you'd make
Shalkel. Shalkel, right.
Right.
But Friday night it has to be over Hagafen. And
holidays.
And right, and then, yeah. No, but this, but Saturday day you can make it over strong drink, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, so... I don't know, and Havdalah can be made in anything.
Right.
Right. But still. Right, so I just wonder, is there a difference in the intoxication? And it's interesting that at the Seder you do have to drink at least that amount. And it's really it's best you should drink wine. It shouldn't be grape juice. It's not just that you should say Bori Pri HaGafen. You should be drinking wine because there is something about the intoxication that's good for the Seder. Mm-hmm. Good for your interaction, that you leave that much judgment behind in participating in the Seder. So I don't know what the mysteries are in that, but there are mysteries in that. And they do say about wine also that nichnas yayin yotze sod. When wine goes in, secrets come out.
Mm-hmm.
And the gematria of wine and the gematria of secret is the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to think about also.
Nichnas?
Goes in.
Okay.
Nichnas. Like misha nichnas adar, okay. From when adar comes in, nichnas is enter. So from when wine enters, secrets come out. So I'm just leaving you with questions, not really with answers. But it's interesting. So it says the root of this is that you shouldn't disrespect the sanctuary. So, which is interesting then that it includes a regular person, because rendering a ruling. But so I think then in that case, sanctuary and learning Torah have to go together, or rendering rulings on Torah, that these are sanctified activities and you can't disrespect them by having alcohol in you. So the Kohen can't even enter the sanctuary in a disrespectful way, and a regular non-Kohen is not allowed to disrespect the law and the process by rendering a ruling. And then it goes on to discuss what are other disrespectful ways a Kohen could enter the sanctuary, and one of them is that his hair would be too long. And the same thing for a non-Kohen is not allowed to go into the sanctuary with excessively long hair. But the definition is different for the two. Excessively long hair for a Kohen is hair that's grown for more than 30 days. A Kohen in service is required to get his hair cut every 30 days, at least.
Even during the count of the Omer?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, if you're serving, you can't go in a disheveled manner. And so it's disheveled if your hair is longer than 30 days long. But for a non-Kohen, it just means long, whatever that means. So I'm not sure exactly if there's another definition or if it's a community-defined thing. You shouldn't look unkempt.
What about a Nazir?
Except for a Nazir. Is he allowed to go in? He must be allowed to go in. He goes in and cuts it off at the end. So he's growing it for a specific purpose. Is he allowed to go in the middle? I don't know. It's a good question. It doesn't address that here. But that would be a very interesting question. Is he allowed to go in? Because, of course, his hair would be too long, depending on how long he's a Nazir for. You know, he could be a Nazir for just a month, or he could be a Nazir for years.
There's an interesting thing here. You know, the ban on entering the sanctuary as in a drunken state applies when the temple is extant. Well, yeah.
Right.
For both men and women.
Right.
So women did have some role in the temple.
Right. So that reminded me of the story of, what's her name? Penina and...
Hannah,
thank you. Hannah, who goes not to the temple but to the Mishkan, and she prays and she looks drunk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he's yelling at her, "What are you coming here drunk? What right do you have?"
I'm pleading with God.
Right. So it's you're not allowed to go. So men and women not allowed to go drunk, and that's why he yells at her. Here's where it says on page 145, a person gave a ruling about something so explicit in the Torah that even the Sadducees would declare it, so it is permissible. For example, if he ruled that a dead crawling creature is ritually unclean or that blood is forbidden and so on, so that's so obvious. And it's interesting, an intoxicated person is permitted to read aloud in the Torah even normative laws and homiletic teachings, but this if he gives no ruling. However, if he is a scholar permanently assigned to render rulings, he should not teach, for his teaching has the authority of a legal decision. Wow. So let's just say, for instance,
world.
Right? So there's a difference between when I teach and when Rabbi Stern teaches. Rabbi Stern is a halachic ruler. That's his job. So when he teaches a class on how to check bugs, even if you didn't ask him a question, when I check lettuce, should I X, Y, or Z? The fact that he just says it, that's a halachic ruling. So he wouldn't be permitted to teach in an intoxicated way.
But
however,
you would.
I would be allowed, probably, to come with, you know, to offer the toast and then read out loud, right? But not to render a judgment, but I would
be
permitted
to read. So we couldn't ask you
questions. Right.
Because you might have to
make a rule. Right. And then this is interesting, too, on the bottom of the page. So Kohanim are divided into watches, right? So they're divided into their father's houses, and then they're further divided into watches. And the watches are the groups that will have to serve at different times.
Like a tribe?
No.
It's a shift.
It's a shift. Good, thank you. Like a shift. A shift within at the time that's going to be serving. So you know that you're part of the shift that's going to be serving from midnight to 8. Mm-hmm. Right? So now the question is, at what point would you be permitted to drink wine? Right? So could you have it for breakfast? Well, you probably could, because you're for sure not going to be drunk by midnight. But how late could you risk it? Could you have it at 8 p.m.? Probably not, because you might still be under some intoxicating influence by midnight. So you'd have to know. So it says not only the people who are on the watch can't drink by a certain time, but neither can other members of their father's house. In case a Kohen who's on the watch will not be able to serve, and then somebody else, a substitute, will be chosen. So all those people who are not designated as on the watch are on the substitute list. So even people on the substitute list can't drink lest they be called.
It's the airline pilot thing.
Right. So, and then anybody who doesn't know which watch he's assigned to or which father's house he's a part of, you might think he can't ever drink. He always has to stand at the ready, but actually it's the opposite. He can drink whenever, because he can't possibly serve if he doesn't know one of those two things. So, Okay.
The one who doesn't even know how to ask.
Right.
What house
so if he doesn't know, then forget about it. He has to know before he can be, before he can serve. So Ramban of blessed memory wrote, however, that it's merely a higher standard set by the sages not to enter the sanctuary drunk with wine. But by Torah law, there's only the restriction that one should not serve when drunk. Right? So here we have don't enter. So this is a machloket then. That just points to a machloket between Rambam and Ramban because this book is written according to the halacha of Rambam. So, but he's bringing this opposing view of Ramban who says, actually, remember, they have two different counts of mitzvot, which we're going to run up against very quickly today, Mirtz Hashem. So, but he does bring sometimes opposing ideas of the Ramban, even though he writes according to the Rambam. So the Rambam is saying that this mitzvah is that the Kohen cannot even enter the sanctuary inebriated at all. And the Ramban says, actually, it's just that he can't do any service, but he could technically enter. Just like one of us could technically enter, but we wouldn't be able to render a ruling. So a Kohen could enter, but wouldn't be able to do any service. So that's the position of the Ramban, but the Rambam says it's all one thing, they can't even enter. Okay, 153. To examine the signs of animals which determine if they are kosher. So this is different than not eating it. This is a specific mitzvah. So here, this mitzvah itself is one of those machlokets. It's interesting. Let's look at the machloket first, and then we'll look at the mitzvah. So on page 149, in the third paragraph, the second indentation. Now here I have not withheld my pen from writing the words of the Rambam of blessed memory about this, who reckoned this verse as a positive precept. So here's the verse. Let's see. The verse is, these are the living things which you may eat among all the beasts that are on the earth, whatever parts the hoof, etc. Meaning, whatever has a split hoof and whatever chews its cud, you're permitted to eat from that. Okay, so based on that verse, we now have a mitzvah to examine those signs. So it doesn't say in the pasuk, and you shall examine the animal to determine if it has the sign so that you could know if you can eat it, right? Mm-hmm. It sort of seems like that's obvious. Like if you're given signs, so then you have to look for them before you know if you can eat from the animal or not, right? So it might be enough just to say you can't eat from those animals that are treif and you can eat from those animals that are kosher. Why do you have to also give a mitzvah that you should examine? That seems like a prerequisite to the mitzvah, right? So Rambam holds that it is a mitzvah to examine. Ramban holds that it's not. He holds that it is a prerequisite. So let's look at this paragraph. Let's see. The Rambam of blessed memory who reckoned this verse as a positive precept. For I resolved at the start of my work to write the precepts in according with the listing as he reckoned them, even though my heart is taken in this matter by the approach of Ramban of blessed memory, who wrote that it is not for us to list the examination for marks of cleanliness in animals as a precept. For in truth, since the Torah prohibited some animals to us, it would be obliged in any event to inform us of the distinguishing marks of the clean or permitted ones in order to separate us from that which, from what is forbidden. And it is thus not fit at all to be counted as a precept in the reckoning. This same ruling and the same reason should hold equally for the examination of fowl and fish and locusts, which Rambam of blessed memory reckons as three precepts, and Ramban of blessed memory does not count.
Ooh, that's where we get the difference.
Right, so that's where we get significant differences in the count of 613. Everybody agrees there's 613, but what are they? So clearly Rambam, right here, we're seeing several of the ones that Rambam counts as part of the 613 that Ramban does not. So I don't know, you know, we have to eventually do some research and see which are the ones that Rambam adds on if you subtract the ones of Rambam that he doesn't hold by. But here's some of them. So this is one of them that Ramban does not hold by, that Rambam does, that you must examine the signs of the animals to determine if they're kosher. So those signs, as we know, are split hooves and chew their cud. And it continues a little bit of what the split hoof looks like and chewing the cud, what that is. And then the rest of the precepts details are in Tractate Chulin, so you can find it. And it remains in force in every place at every time for men and women. If a person violated it and made no examination, but merely saw one distinguishing mark and relied on that to eat of it, even if he should discover after that he ate permissible food, he would thus disobey this positive precept of examining the distinguishing marks. So we don't run up against this much today. We completely rely on the Hechsher, right? So we just buy it in the store and we're done. But if, let's say, one of us happened to be, I don't know, on a deserted island and we found a cow and we knew how to shecht, we would first just have to check its hooves and its mm-hmm. cud and make sure. So I don't think it says in this one, but it does say by the other animals that you can just rely on, it's already been checked. So we all, like for instance, we know cows are kosher. You don't have to check them every time. So it may be, it just doesn't say here.
Find a species.
Is chewing the cud something you can see? I thought it was kind of like a physiologic thing, that it's a process of how they eat, that they chew it twice.
Yeah, but it says they don't have
appetite. See the second the stomach.
Right, so it is ejected from the stomach and comes back up. You certainly see cows chewing their cud.
But right? What's the cud? Isn't that just the food?
I think it would be different if you watch them, if you're, you know, in Wild Kingdom, right, filming the animals like they used to back in Mutual of Omaha days. Uh-huh. So there's the ripping off of the grass and eating. So you probably see the grass on the outside of their mouth, right, chewing. But then there's the cow just standing in the field just chewing its cud. Like your grandmother said, you shouldn't chew gum because you look like a cow chewing its cud. My grandmother used to say that to me. Because they just stand there chewing and they're not eating.
So that's you're assuming that it's
that's
the
cud.
That's come
well,
up.
Right, no, right, that's the cud.
It's defined much more. It says, animals which chew its cud have no teeth in the upper jaw. On the bottom of 149.
Yeah, I see that.
So
right,
that's
and it talks about the species, yeah.
Do cows only have teeth on the bottom?
I the first time I've ever heard this.
It says
every domestic animal, every domestic
pigs.
Animal in the world that chews its cud has cloven hooves except the camel, and everyone with cloven hooves chews its cud
every
except the pig.
Every wild animal which chews its cud has no teeth in the upper jaw.
That's a wild, right?
Every domestic and wild.
Mm-hmm. Wait. There are 10 species among domestic and wild animals that are permissible.
You're right.
The three known kinds of domestic animals, namely the ox, sheep, and goat.
The first sentence in that paragraph.
Some laws of the priest of Dora that every kosher domestic and wild animals chews a cud has no teeth in the upper jaw. Interesting.
Never heard that.
Yeah.
Well, isn't there more than just that? I mean, isn't the real ultra-Orthodox, they have to examine the stomach and the intestines, and they have to do a lot more?
Everybody, not just the ultra-Orthodox. Everybody does. For it to be kosher, you have to check.
So where is that saying?
It doesn't have to say that here. That the animal, where does it say that the animal has to be healthy? That's why you're examining it. It's a different thing. The animal, I think when we were learning about a trepha, an animal that was torn apart, mm-hmm. right? That's when we learned about that.
Okay.
That if it's torn or if it's damaged, even if it didn't die from it, but it will die from it, mm-hmm. remember we talked about then, you can't run and shecht it at that moment while it's still alive. Because if it will die from its injuries or disease within a year, it's not kosher. You have to shecht it. The death has to come from the shechita. So if it would come from something else within a year, then the animal itself is not kosher. So it has to be a healthy animal that's not going to die on its own within a year. Because of that, we check the insides to see, did it have any diseases? How do you know if it's going to die within a year? Do you have a crystal ball? You don't. So what we use instead is a physical examination to see if it has signs of disease, which are the type of disease that would cause it, even if it looks healthy today. You know, are there beginning signs of disease? Because a year is a long time for a disease to incubate. So you need to see, are there the seeds of disease in it that would incubate into a death within a year?
But this is the first more obvious examination.
Oh, right. That's a separate examination. After shechita mm-hmm. is to examine if the animal is healthy.
Okay.
The examination before shechita is to see if it's a kosher species.
Okay.
Right? And then that makes a difference too. It talks about here that there's two different types of kosher species. There's domestic and there's wild. And mm-hmm. the laws are different. Domestic animals don't have to have their blood covered, and wild animals do, right? I hope I didn't mix that up. And also the chalav of a domestic animal, I think, can't be eaten, whereas the chalav of a wild animal can.
What's the
chalav? It's the fat.
The chalav is the fat on top of the kidneys and the liver, I think.
And why is that?
That's the halacha. Is that, so the halacha of all of this, according to the Sefer Chinuch, because he says, why can't you eat certain things? And it's interesting because this is also opposite than what some Kabbalists will say. But his answer, why can't you eat these things, is because God knows what's healthy and not healthy. And what's even in minute amounts. And since the body is the vessel of the soul, and the soul can't do its work in a body that's blocked by even small bits of unhealth because of eating some of these things, so God took out of our diet those things that would cause the soul blockage in its work. So it's not just about straight up physical health, but it is about the fact that you're bringing into your body certain things that might block the soul's activities. So, but it is much more physical. The way he explains it is much more physical. The way that Rabbi Akiva Tatz explains it, so that's based on more of a Kabbalistic thing, is that because God said you can't eat these things, they became unhealthy. That the halacha is causative, not responsive. Yeah.
Because the other way you said it, it kind of makes us say, when people say, well, you do that because it's not healthy, and now we know it's okay to eat pork because they...
No more trichinosis.
Yeah. Right. So the first way you explained it, then it would kind of make it seem like, well, nowadays it should be.
Right, so if it's health concerns. So I can see that maybe, I mean, so it's differently. It's different because that is the way, let's see if I can see his paragraph. Here's just a summary on page 149, the second paragraph. What lies at the root of a ban on certain food, we wrote above about the injunction on a trefa, a fatally injured animal, and on forbidden fat in 149. So we looked at those, in 147, we looked at those two, which we have known. But he's just summarized it quickly. This is a root reason that is enough. Wait, I'm just not tracking well. That is enough in accord with the plain meaning for them all. Now the purpose of examining, there was a summary earlier that I read, let's see. Now the purpose of examining their determining marks follows from these reasons, for their forbiddance, whatever is the possible subject of a ban that we will have been given, is right and obligatory for us to inspect it as well. Okay, so that's not where he gives a little summary, though, earlier. But anyway, if you want to look up in those two, that's where he talks about why you can't eat it. But where is that? There was just a one-paragraph quick summary of those reasons, which is basically that it's not... He doesn't say it's not neshamically healthy, but that is what he's saying, is that you take into your physical body that which makes it hard for your neshama to do its work. If it would just be healthy and not healthy... So then we'd have all the problems with the sugar and everything else that we're eating today. That is not the underlying principle of kashrut. Mm-hmm. We do, basically. There was just a big article about it in Jewish Action? It couldn't be the Jewish Observer, because they just stopped publishing that, right? So in Jewish Action. It was in Jewish Action about, is the Orthodox lifestyle unhealthy? And it actually was an indictment of all the food that we eat in the Orthodox world, the kiddushes and the simchas and all the sudot mitzvah. We have mitzvah meals that we're supposed to eat, but do we need to eat as much as we do? And so it was really pointing out that the Orthodox lifestyle, not halacha, but lifestyle, is an unhealthy one.
Contributing to obesity like everything.
Yes, it is. Hmm. Yes, it is. So it was an indictment of the Orthodox lifestyle in the OU magazine. So it's not an anti-religious magazine, but it was saying, look at us, guys. What are we doing? But the halacha, the straight-up halacha, doesn't forbid it. Certainly the subtle halacha does. And anybody who's eating to live, not living to eat, which is not most of us, but anybody who's careful to eat to fuel their body and also keep kosher to fuel their soul, so then they'd be much more careful about what they put in their bodies than I am. So, and the majority of the community, you know, we eat all kinds of stuff and justify it because it's Shabbos. We can have dessert. We're supposed to have oneg. Yeah, we are supposed to have oneg, but, you know, does it mean that much sugar?
Fruit and oneg.
Right. So, yeah, that's a problem. Chocolate mousse is yummier sometimes than the just cut up pineapple.
What's the sometimes?
So it's clearly not just because of health. Okay, so now let's look at 154. So you'd think that 154 makes sense according to both camps, which it does, and that you wouldn't need 153 to examine the signs, because if you have the prohibition against eating any non-kosher animal, you have to be able to examine it to know if it's kosher or not, right? So, but here, 154 is the prohibition against eating any non-kosher animal, which is different than the trefa that we saw earlier. Right, not to eat any unclean kind of domestic or wild animal, for it is stated, these you shall not eat of those that chew the cud or part of the hoof, or part the hoof, the camel, the rock badger, the hare, and the swine. So it's interesting because it says, these you shall not eat of.
Right.
Because it's so we know that the two signs are choose its cud and has a split hoof. Here it's saying part the hoof. But so the split hoof and chew the cud. But it's saying in this pasuk, in this phrase, in these few pasukim, what it's saying is, here are some animals that chew their cud and have split hooves. So when I first heard that slash read that, because I listen out loud, I have, you know, the Chumash read out loud that I listen to. So I'm not sure if I read it or heard it. But it said, these are the animals that chew their cud and have split hooves that you're not allowed to eat from the hare because it chews its cud but doesn't have split hooves. I thought, wait a second, is it both? So what it's saying is it's one or the other. They don't have both. Here are the two signs. Here's a list of animals that has one of those two.
Only one. Mm-hmm.
Right, only one of those two. So in that list, the camel, the rock badger, the hare, the swine have only one of those two. You can't eat from them.
I never liked camel anyway.
So it's interesting, so you can't eat from them. And it says, just from a kal v'chomer. So on the next page, you'll see on page 153, the second paragraph, how other kinds of domestic and wild animals were forbidden to us by a kal v'chomer. A reasoning a, however you say that in Latin, we need Sandy for that, a
fortiori.
Thank you, a fortiori. As we say, if regarding the pig or the camel, which each have one of the marks, whiplashes are given over it, how much more certain is it about other domestic and wild animals which have no mark of them that you're not allowed to eat them? So we learn from a kal v'chomer that you can't eat any animal that doesn't have both of them. Because here's a list of ones that have one of them and you can't eat. So it doesn't even have to say, it's interesting, it doesn't have to say you can't eat any other animal. It says these are the ones you can eat. Here's a list of ones you can't eat. But just because there's something else on that list, right, where's elephants there? Giraffes. Nowhere on either list. Giraffes are kosher.
Giraffes are kosher?
Yeah, they have split hooves and they chew their cud.
Oh, I would think they'd be like camel.
No,
camel family.
They're kosher.
Interesting.
They're kosher. Yeah. As a matter of fact...
Where do you shecht it, though? That's the problem.
Well, actually, they know where to shecht it now. I thought
really?
It was a question. Yeah. So there's an interesting story. The OU dinner a few years ago, I think it was being held in Los Angeles, they wanted to serve every kind of kosher animal they could.
Wow.
So, as you know, my husband is still friends with somebody who used to own the kosher bison plant. Right? So at the time that he owned the plant, so he shechted unusual animals. That was his thing. Mm. So they found a giraffe,
wow,
that, which they purchased,
wow,
that they were going to shecht for this dinner. So a few days before the giraffe was to be shipped to the plant, the owner called and said, so where, which zoo am I sending this to? They said, no, it's to a schlachthaus, to a slaughtering facility. He said, to a slaughtering facility? He said, yeah, we're going to serve it at the OU dinner. He said, not my giraffe. You're not serving at the OU dinner.
Oh.
No, you're not. And the sale was canceled.
Oh.
He was not selling it for meat. He was selling it for a pet or a zoo.
Oh.
So we could have known where to shecht it, but... so we must know where to shecht it because they were going to, but they weren't permitted to,
wow,
buy the giraffe for that. So,
You kind of think of it as an elegant animal, not an animal you'd want to eat.
Yeah.
Right, and yet it's an edible,
yeah,
you're allowed to.
Kosher.
It's kosher. It's kosher.
Hmm.
So elephants, let's say, they're not on the list, right? But they don't have either of the signs. So you learn that from a kal v'chomer. A kal v'chomer is you learn from the... You learn from the more lenient, the more stringent. So if you say you can't eat something that has one sign of the two, then you for sure know you can't eat something that doesn't have either sign.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a kal v'chomer. let's see. Oh, here's the little summary at page 153 at the bottom. At the root of this precept lies what we wrote about the injunction against the trefa in Sedra Mishpatim, that God knows that in all foods which he removed from the people, he chose elements injurious to the body are found. Our bodies being vessels and instruments for the souls to work through them and to be ennobled through their good deeds. So the bodies are to be ennobled by the soul's good deeds. For this reason, he removed us from them the injurious food elements so that the souls could do their functions and no bad temperament of the body or stupor of the heart will shut the door before them, as I wrote there.
Hmm.
So this is not just about medieval medicine that talks about the
mm-hmm.
the different temperaments. What is it called? The four different...
Humors.
Yeah, humors. Thank you. It's not just about the humors. But here it talks about stupor of the heart. So there's timtum halev is something that we... And it says over here in the Hebrew, timtum halevavot. That stupor of the heart is caused by non-kosher food. So that when one eats non-kosher food, one's not able to learn with as much clarity or sometimes even clarity at all, that they don't have a spiritual vision. It's clouded.
But that can be reversed.
Yes, it can be reversed.
Right?
Yes, it can.
Probably never to the point where...
I think it can be reversed completely, I think. I'm not positive about it. But I know that there is some talk, and I never heard a Rav say it up straight as a Dvar Halacha, but that one reason why those getaway Shabbaton weekends are considered effective in helping people shift into more observance is that they only eat kosher food the whole time. So that at the time that you're learning those things, you're being fueled only on kosher food.
Uh-huh.
So that is...
Even though your flesh can be made of non-kosher food.
Right.
Instead it becomes flesh of your, you know...
Right, so I think that is a problem because
you are what you eat.
It takes a while to purify the system.
It must take a long time.
All tshuvas that
right
get it.
They're all tshuvas, and what would they have been like? Though there's a question: what would they have been like if they never would have?
Exactly.
I mean, we know that food is an important thing. I mean, we know we learned that from Moshe, who wouldn't nurse from a Mitzri woman.
Right.
Right. So even mother's milk. You know, which a baby could have. It's not even, you know, but he wouldn't have from somebody who ate non-kosher food. Had to be from a Jewish woman.
Wait a minute, so. I thought his mother nursed him.
Yeah, so the Midrash, so in the Pusuk, Miriam says, shall I go find a woman from the Hebrews who will nurse him? So the Midrash fills in the blank. Batya has now rescued him, and he's not nursing. What's the story? Like she's offering him wet nurses and he refuses, but he's still crying because he's so hungry. So that's what gives her the opportunity to say, shall I find you one of the Hebrew women to nurse him? Because you've tried the Mitzri women and he's not taking it. Mm. There's a problem here, clearly. Let me go find a Hebrew woman. Maybe that will work. So that's what the Midrash fills in between the verses.
Then Moses
and that's
that
and that's why okay. That's why she was able to say, yes, go find me somebody. And then here she runs to his mother and says, you know, come
so
nurse.
So Moses was supposed to know that they weren't Jewish women?
So apparently know. that's what the Midrash says, is that the mouth that would teach the Jews Torah
right.
couldn't have taken in non-kosher food.
Oh, and so breast milk from a non-Jew.
Right, yeah. Right,
kosher.
Right. Even that level. He couldn't take in, yeah, that his mouth had to be, so his mouth and then his body had to be a totally kosher vessel to be able to express Torah. Mm. So I imagine that it is a problem, even, you know, for those of us who ate non-kosher food and, you know, so it is still there because our brains were formed on it and our lungs were formed, like all of us, you know, because, you know, depending on what our mothers ate in their pregnancy, so then the initial formation, and then depending on what we ate in our lives, so subsequent formation. So, and yet, once we make a decision, so there's the physical reality of it being part of us, and then there's the spiritual reality of a decision that we made later to not have that in us anymore, and so that the thought process, I think, has more clarity, because it's the timtum halev is not physical. It's caused by physical. But it can be changed by the spiritual. So
what? Timtum halev again, something
so the heart.
Timtum.
It's the stupor of the heart.
Stupor of the heart.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, you do regenerate new cells.
Right. So, but what I'm saying is, I don't think it's all about that.
Right.
I think it's also about the eating the food and just the immediate energy being provided by the kosher food. So, and there's all kinds of stories. You hear all kinds of stories of the old. Like from old Eretz Yisrael, old Yerushalmi, like there was a boy who I remember thinking about this story once, and somebody, I think I was waiting for a ride when I was in the army by some side post, and somebody wasn't going the right direction. I was in the middle of nowhere, but somebody who was driving by in the wrong direction gave me a bunch of grapes to eat, which was nice, right? So now I'm standing in the middle of nowhere, but at least I have a snack. But then I wondered, have Tremot and Masrot been separated from these grapes? I don't know. Like, can I eat them or not? I would just look, because you're in the land of Israel. Like, so what do you know about those grapes? Where did those grapes come from? Did they come straight from the field? Did they come from a grocery store? Like, what? So, and I remember at that time recalling a story of some Yerushalmi boy who was, you know, a good student and behaving well, like, you know, good Yerushalmi boys do, but at 8 he became rebellious or something. And they traced the rebellion back to the fact that he ate some grapes that hadn't had chermot and masrot separated from them.
Wow. Now, what's chermot?
So you didn't eat them.
I think I did. I don't remember. But I remember standing there thinking, like, what? I want to, like, be like that boy.
Turn into what is it? What is it that you just said? Chermot and masrot?
The tithes. The Kohanic and Levitical tithes that one is still required in the land of Israel today to separate from produce grown in the land of Israel. Oh. So even if you would be here and see Jaffa oranges, and I think Jaffa oranges have them separated, but you have to know if the Israeli produce that you buy in this country, any produce grown in the land of Israel has to have the tithes separated from it before you're allowed to eat it.
And the tithes is what? The food for charity? Or what is it?
Yeah, well, so there's food for the Kohanim and for the Levi'im and for charity. So the first is for the Kohanim. Since the Kohanim don't have, I don't think it's the corners of the field.
No, that's
a separate thing.
That's for the charity.
That's
paya,
right. Right. Or that's separate. Because it doesn't usually say on a can of pickles, you know, paya was observed in the pickle field, in the cucumber field. But Trumot and Masrot were separated. That has to be.
Every year. The first fruit.
That's Bikurim. That's separate.
So what are we talking about?
There's all kinds of different food tithes, right? Yeah. So a tithe specifically refers to the 10%. The word tithe is the tithing. And so we talk about tithing our income also, which comes from that. But there's all kinds of food separations, we'll just say, that we have to do. So first fruits is one of them, Bikurim. So that's for fruits of the tree, for actual fruits, right? So when you see a blossom on your apple tree, the first blossom that's going to grow into the first apple. Because once the tree is in bloom, let's say, you know, it's the middle of the summer. I don't know when you harvest apples, but let's say it's the middle of August, right? Mm-hmm. And your tree is full of apples. How do you know which was the first apple on the tree? Mm-hmm. So what you do is you go out in May when you see the first buds, and you tie a string on them so that by the time it's ripened, you know which was the first fruit. And then you harvest those first fruits, and they're brought as Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash. Now, I don't know how Bikurim is, if that's observed at all today or not. I'm not sure about Bikurim. However, so that's one, Bikurim, first fruits. Another is a tenth of all the produce that's grown in the land of Israel is separated off for the Kohanim, for the Levi'im. A tenth is for the Levi'im. From that tenth, because the Levi'im, the whole Levitical tribe, has no portion in the land of Israel.
Right. So they still have a place they can go and get their own fruit.
That they don't go to get it. You bring it to them. You harvested your wheat, and now you take off a tenth, and you bring it to the Levi. The Levi then has to take off a tenth of what he was just given, so that's a hundredth of the whole thing, and bring it to the Kohen. Mm. So the Kohen, which is a subset
so
of the tribe of Levi.
They have selected Levian and Kohanim that they do this with?
So today. Let's move back one second. So the tenth that separated off for the Levi, and then the Levi is required to separate off the next tenth. So that next tenth, the one that goes to the Kohen, is called Truma. And the first tenth is called Ma'aser from the word Eser, right? Ma'aser, that's a tithe, that's the tenth, right? That's Ma'aser. The part that goes to the Kohen is called Truma. Truma can only be eaten Bikedusha. Betahara, right? So you can only have that betahara. So since today everybody's tamei meit, it cannot be eaten. And yet it must be separated. And it can only be eaten. So now the question is, you have the whole land of Israel so fruitful, right? And what do you do with that hundredth? A hundredth.
That's a lot of fruit.
Is a lot of fruit and grain and vegetables. All of it.
Any produce.
Any food stuff that grows from the ground, you have to separate this. So what do you do with that hundredth of it? So Jews are smart, it turns out. So it can be eaten by the Kohanim and their animals. Mm-hmm. So the whole biblical zoo belongs to Kohanim and is fed with that. So it doesn't go to waste, right? How smart, right?
And do we know when we shop at the shuk what's been?
You have to see a sign. Okay. Yes, you do.
Say that.
Yep, and it will say Trumot and Maseret have been separated from this produce, and you'll have a hechsher for that. And so here in this country, you can buy a fruit or a vegetable, no problem. That's like kosher free.
What about fruit from Israel that you buy?
You have to know. That's right.
It was just during the Shemitah year.
No, that's extra. That's like Pesach on top of regular. Right, no, that's extra. This is all the time. Fruit is not a free pass in the land.
So tell me what it should say.
It should say Trumot and Maseret were separated. Hufreshu, Trumot u'Maseret. Right? So, and usually it says Ein Chashash, Trumot u'Maseret. And then there's another one too. Ein Chashash. Right? Usually it'll say Chashash is suspicion. Chashash.
Okay.
So, but it'll say Trumot u'Maseret. Just look and make sure it says Trumot u'Maseret, Hufreshu. Or Hufreshu, Trumot u'Maseret. They separated Trumot u'Maseret. So now the Maaser, that tenth. So you take out the truma that has to only be eaten in Tahara, but the maaser, that tenth, does not. So that can be redeemed on coins. That's what we do today. We redeem it on a coin because we don't have levium to give it to, really. So we redeem it on a coin and then give that to tzedakah, and then anybody can eat it.
So we take whatever it's worth.
I'm not exactly sure how it works. I mean, there's a formula in the Siddur, and you can do it. And I don't know spiritually how it works because you redeem it on less than what it's worth.
And then you get
I don't know why you're allowed to do it. Yeah.
And then what happens to that produce?
And then you can eat it.
Anybody can eat it.
And that also has, but that goes in a 7-year cycle, the Shemitah year cycle. And I don't know I don't remember exactly, but I think twice, either 2 or 3 out of the 6 years, because you don't do it for the Shemitah year, right? It goes to it's Maaser Ani. So it's which goes to poor people. So every other year, basically, it goes to the levy, and every other year, it goes to the poor person.
Well, the coins go to the levy? You just said there weren't any.
No, I'm saying the food, just so you should know where it actually is supposed to go. So
you're not redeeming it if you're practicing it.
Right.
Every other year, it goes to the levy.
And every other year, it goes to poor people.
So how is this identified then? What the coins in Israel are identified so that
the kohenim? There's a tradition: who's a kohen and who's a levi, just like today in here too. How do you know who gets called up for an aliyah?
My dad was a levi, so I know.
Right. So you're about levi.
Yeah.
You're about levi.
My grandson.
Right. So that we have laws that pertain to that. Not too many left over. But for a levy, for instance, so he gets a second aliyah and is not allowed to take another aliyah. Basically, he can take second or last of the aliyahs. And then also, he doesn't do pidyon haben. So if a levy's wife's first child is a boy, there's no pidyon haben ceremony. And even a bat levy, the daughter of a levy, when she marries even a Yisrael, her first son, if she has a son first, there's no pidyon haben because they're already part of the service tribe, so you don't have to redeem them.
Kohanim nor levium have a pidyon haben.
That's what I'm saying. Kohanim and levium do not have a pidyon haben, and a bat levi and a bat kohen also, even if they marry Israel, does not have a pidyon haben. That's pretty much what's left over for the levium, and then also the levium wash the hands of the kohanim before they duchen, before they give the bracha birkat kohanim. That's basically what's left over for levium today. But we still have a masorah who's a levi, because that's who does it. Your father teaches you as a child, it's time for the duchenin. Everybody go out. The kohanim, the kohanic fathers are telling their sons, take your shoes off and line up to be washed by the levium, where the Levitical fathers are teaching their sons, line up to wash the hands of the kohanim. So there is that. At least that Masorah is being taught over. And then the Kohanic father is also teaching his son, don't go to a cemetery, don't walk under a tree that's hanging over a cemetery, don't go into a cemetery, don't go into hospitals, unless there's a sign that says you're allowed to go in. It's mutter for Kohanim to go in. In Israel, they have a sign on the front of the hospital, Kohanim may enter, Kohanim may not enter, depending on if there's a dead body or not in that building. So they know to be careful about that. And it's interesting, I was on the bus in Israel that was driving from the old city to Jericho, which means it has to pass through the Mount of Olives, which is a cemetery. There's a road that goes through. There's a Kohen on the bus. He asked everybody to close the windows while they drove through. This is before air conditioning. So it was hot and stuffy. But everybody obliged because there's a Kohen on the bus. You're not going to have a Kohen go through a cemetery with the windows open.
Only in there.
Right?
Amazing.
Well, when are you going? June 30th. Because my understanding is there's dead buried everywhere. That's what Mike Tversky told us.
That's interesting. So my understanding...
It's true.
Yeah, there are dead buried a lot. So it's not a problem, as far as I understand, for a Kohen to, I think, even walk in a cemetery or, like, for instance, the botanical gardens, if they're non-Jews. Non-Jewish dead has a lower level of tumah than Jewish dead.
Rabbi, I think Alter is. He will perform a Leviat on the road at Rose Hill where there are no trees.
Yeah. You're allowed to do that.
Rabbi Kahan will go onto the road.
Right. You're allowed to do that. Yeah, Rabbi Kahan went into the road too. Yeah. Where there's no trees. And they keep the trees cut back for that reason. That they can just step into that part, like right by where you wash your hands, right? Mm-hmm. They can step there. Because that's not.
But then there are exceptions taken when one of seven.
If it's one of your Shiva relatives, then the Kohen is permitted to go to the burial, but never to visit the grave. Mm-hmm. That's it. They can go for the burial. That's when they get to go to the cemetery. So they usually bury Kohanim by the edges so that you can visit by not going into the cemetery, by going to the edge.
Uh-huh. They don't always do that.
You just toss a rock over the fence.
Everyone's tummy mate.
Right, so, but the thing is, there's still a mesorah of who's who and that there are halachas that apply.
You do try to be careful.
Yeah, you do try to be careful. One thing that I really enjoyed about Rabbi Kagan's drasha, his Shabbos HaGadol drasha. You were there, right? So at the very end, he talked about how Mashiach won't come Erev Yontif. This was Shabbos, and then it was Sunday, and then it was Monday. Monday night is Yontif, is Pesach. Mm-hmm. Right? So he's now giving the Shabbos HaGadol drasha. He said, for sure Mashiach is not going to come Erev Yontif, because it would be too much on the housewives. That's the Masorah.
He will not come
Erev Yontif, and he will not come Erev Shabbos because it's too much for the Baal Busta. It would just send her too much.
Why?
Right? So she said
for not,
and plus, how do you make Yontif with all the tumult of the travel and everything? It's just too much. So if the Baal Busta's kavod will push off the coming of Mashiach, if that's how important her kavod is, how respectful should a husband be when he goes home, Erev Yontif, and sees maybe something wasn't done, or how much should he be helping? If her kavod is pushing off Mashiach coming, so respectful. However, there's still Sunday, and Mashiach could still come tomorrow, he said. So in case Mashiach comes tomorrow, here are some halachas of Pesach once Mashiach comes. Just wanted to make sure that we would know. You have to form a chabura. Everybody should get together in a group, and those groups have to be formed before you give the Karban Pesach. It was just so nice to be reminded of halachas that we might need if Mashiach comes tomorrow.
Love it.
Right? How beautiful is that?
It was
fabulous.
It didn't come.
So it was sad that he didn't come, but it was like really nice. It was like exciting to be reminded, like, yeah, he could come tomorrow. And if he does, we need to know the halacha.
What do we need to know?
We needed to know how to make Pesach.
Because
it would be different. Pesach is still going to be there, but now if Mashiach's there, the halachas are different. So he told us some of the halachas, so we should know.
So can you quickly tell us?
I can't.
I want to hear it.
Esther, do you remember?
I don't remember that.
No, but he did say that we need to make a chabura before.
But he didn't go into it.
He did not go into it in depth.
A lamb at that point.
No, I think, you know.
A chabura composition?
A chabura, oh, good. No.
What did you say?
A chibur is a composition. A chabura is a group together.
Like chabur to eat the paschal lamb. Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh. You have to make that chabura. You have to designate your chabura before you bring the korban. Well, anyway, we couldn't have brought the korban. I think that's what he was saying, too. Anyway, you couldn't bring the korban because we're all tamei meit. So we would have had a different type of Pesach. We would have had to bring the korban Pesach and Pesach Sheni because we wouldn't have been ready by Pesach, by the regular Pesach. But it was just nice to have a Kohen who holds the laws for us. You know, because that's his job. He can't serve in the Beit HaMikdash. But as a Kohen, it's his job to learn more and to be the container that carries it from generation to generation because he's the Kohen. So we do still have, that's how we know. That's the answer to the question. How do we know who's the Kohen and the Levi? It is transferred generation to generation. You know.
Father to son.
Father to son. Right. It is transferred. So so that's
how
we know.
My dad didn't do any of that with my
No, he did not. But he at least knew.
Yeah, well, yeah, it says on my ketubah.
Right, it says in your ketubah. Okay, so that at least it's known. And so your brothers know. So if they have sons who are Jewish, they'll teach their sons, you're a Levi. And then when their son hopefully becomes a Baal Tshuva, then they'll say, actually, I'm a Levi. And then somebody will teach them the halachas. But at least it's passed on that they know they're a Levi. And they know that from their father who passed it on from his father. It's on your ketubah. So that's enough information. It's actually a question once it gets that far out of observance. Some Kohanim are that far out of observance. I knew one who wanted to go to medical school, which is a problem because you have to dissect cadavers and you can't really, a Kohen can't easily be a doctor and keep halachas of Kohanim.
Oh, really?
So he wanted to be a Kohen and he wanted to be a doctor and he was a Kohen and he was a Baal Tshuva and he was like, you know, all torn up about the fact that now that he's a Frum, he can't be a doctor, which is what he always wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So he asked the Shaila about it and they said, how do you know you're a Kohen? He said, well, my father told me, he said, investigate. Because if your family hasn't been observant for a few generations, it might not be. And they investigated and he wasn't.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. Mistakes can be made. All right, so we didn't get to finish this whole thing, but we did get to interesting things. And
you know the Kaufmans just found out they are Kaufmans.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Dimitri's
that's nice.
A Kohen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Cool. Wow, good thing she's not a Kiyaret. Or a divorcee.
Yeah.
That can make big trouble.
So tell me again what...
Sure. I just want to remind you it's the 13th day of the Omer in case you didn't count last night.